TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. A Little Matter of Genocide by Ward Churchill. On September 11, 2012, the Denver Post reported that the former professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado, Ward Churchill, had been denied reinstatement to his job. He is one of this country's foremost writers and activists on Native American studies. In an almost perfect symmetry, the firing of Ward Churchill from his job as tenured professor had been based on an article Churchill wrote after September 11, 2001. He wrote, quote, "If U.S. foreign policy results in massive death and destruction abroad, we cannot feign innocence when some of that destruction is returned." End quote. Fired in 2007, Churchill filed a civil lawsuit for wrongful termination. He won the suit, with a jury saying his rights to free speech under the First Amendment were violated by the school. But the district court judge declined to reinstate him, and the state Supreme Court denied Churchill's appeal in 2012. In the intervening years, Churchill was attacked for lack of scholarship, as well as lack of sufficient blood quantum to be listed Indian. Issues that had not been raised in the 17 years of his tenure as professor of ethnic studies since 1990. The talk you are about to hear is based on his 1997 book, A Little Matter of Genocide. It is a shattering and deeply disturbing survey of ethnic cleansing in the Americas. Churchill compares the treatment of North American Indians to historical instances of genocide by the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, Turks against Armenians, as well as Nazis against the Poles and Jews. In this first part of a one-hour talk, Churchill covers the question of how many Indians may have lived north of the Rio Grande at the time of contact, and why certain scholars and colonizers had an interest in understating those numbers. Here's Ward Churchill. I recorded him at City Lights in San Francisco. City Lights published this and other books by Churchill.
Where I find myself with this book, which is kind of the culmination in a way of maybe 10 years of prior endeavor, is to try to bring forth two dimensions of a given phenomena, which I think is definitive of the nature of the experience of indigenous people for the last 500 years in this hemisphere, and conversely, the definition of the nature of the existence of that which has usurped and supplanted indigenous realities here. In the first facet, it's an exploration of the genocide which has been imposed, a concomitant to the expropriation of virtually the entirety of the hemisphere from its aboriginal owners. And a second facet, which cannot be uncoupled from the first, is what might be properly referred to as denial of that reality. Denial of the Holocaust that has occurred here in exactly the same sense that Arthur Butz and Paul Rassinier and other Nazis, neo or literal, have engaged in with respect to the Holocaust of Jews, Gypsies, at least certain sectors of the Slavic population, and other target groups in Eastern Europe primarily during the 1940s. There's a very great distinction, I think, between the Butzes and the Rassiniers on the one hand and the practitioners of the denial. And that is, when you're dealing with the neo-Nazis and the denial of the Holocaust of the Jews and others, you're dealing with what is self-evidently a lunatic fringe. Marginalized, capable of injecting a certain confusion sometimes to the discourse, but of very little else. With respect to the denial that I address, you have anything but a lunatic fringe. you have essentially the canon, historically, anthropologically, sociologically, in terms of political economy, and otherwise. You have academic orthodoxy. You have, if I can borrow a phrase from William Bennett and use it in a way that he never quite intended, the purveyors of political correctitude. You have the official truth, which, of course, as is usually the case in such things, is precisely the opposite. As Goebbels put it, the bigger the lie, the more likely it is to be believed. And in this case, I think we find proof positive. And I'd like to go into a bit of this. The first aspect of the entire process has been, and very much continues to be, what Deborah Lipschitz and others have referred to as a minimizing school. She makes specific reference in applying that term to Paul Rastignier, whose argument has never really been that the Holocaust in Eastern Europe never occurred, but rather that it's been vastly exaggerated and used for political advantage by purported victims of that process. And the parallel I find is precisely this. Since 1939 in this country, it's been anthropological truth canonized, enshrined, and advanced as if they had had door-to-door head counters capable of entering time machines and going back to the period circa 1500 when the process begins, that north of the Rio Grande, there were, at a point of first contact, not more than 1 million human inhabitants. I doubt there's a person in the room who has not had that truth trumpeted to them, elementary school, thereon, whenever the subject of American Indians or Native Americans or Amerinds or whatever particular monstrosity of terminology they wish to seek to define the indigenous population by. Every Thanksgiving, at least, because that's when they talk about Indians in the public school system, beginning in about the first grade, with a little turkey feather show. All the little kids get to put their turkey feathers on and come to the room where the other little kids from the other class who have cut out their little construction paper, white bibs, or whatever it is they fancy the Pilgrim Fathers dressed like as they starve to death in the deepening snows of November, to talk about how people who are habitually described as being squalid, Stone Age, hunting and gathering savages, wandering nomadically about the North American landscape on the bare margin of subsistence year in, year out, decade in, decade out, century in, century out, millennia in, millennia out, came and fed them what? Corns and beans and squash and pumpkins and cranberries, and which of those things do you hunt? And which of these hybridized food strains of vegetal matter do you gather? And who was it that was being fed with these clearly agricultural products besides a refugee sector of a fishing culture? And do you hunt fish or gather fish? Well, you certainly don't grow it in a field. It ties to the 1 million count, that description, which flies in the face of the celebration. You can't put these two together, that these people bring agricultural products to feed the starving Pilgrim Fathers on the one hand and have this squalid, nomadic, dispersed hunting and gathering population on the other. Either they're farmers and can feed the Pilgrims or they're hunters and gatherers and can't, but you can't have it both ways, yet habitually in the indoctrination process they do, and no one ever seems to experience the proverbial light bulb turning on that says, hey, there's something really wrong with one of these two pictures. But in order for there to have been only 1 million people north of the Rio Grande in 1500, it would be necessary that they be hunters and gatherers, you see. Since in this entire continental landmass, 1 million people would be spread so thin by definition that they would be unable to coalesce into aggregations that would be capable in their interactive properties to generate higher forms of culture. And of course, the fact, with quotes around it, that there were only 1 million, signifies conversely that they had to be Stone Age savages. Those of you who followed the quincentennial debate coming into 1992 might have seen a revolutionary breakthrough in demographic information, because it was conceded by the Smithsonian Institution in that year, apparently in honor of the Columbian landfall, that there may have well have been a full 100% error in the rearward demographic projections, that quite possibly there were 2 million people north of the Rio Grande. Now, 1 million, 2 million sounds incidental, but for those of you who may be pursuing graduate studies at the University of California at Berkeley, which I understand is right over my shoulder, try being off in your statistical projections to your graduate committee by a factor of 100% and see where you end up. Certainly, you won't be enshrined as a dean of American anthropology like Al Kroeber or Jim Mooney. Yeah, that is precisely the fact. Why, though I find this to be significant? Because whatever number you begin with in the hemisphere is a number that you will peg against the 1890 census count undertaken by the U.S. Bureau of Census, and when they did, in fact, go door to door and counted 237,100 and change live American Indian bodies remaining within the borders of the 48 contiguous states. And the argument has always been that from a figure of 1 million to reduce to an approximate 1/4 million indicates a population reduction of, you can do the arithmetic, 75%, which of course is about the degree of impact that is commonly projected as having occurred with respect to the Jewish population of Eastern Europe at the hands of the Nazis. And so, of course, no one can reasonably make a claim that what it was that was done in this hemisphere is in fact worse than what it was that was done there. Fairly odd defensive posture, wouldn't you think? Say what you want, but we weren't any worse than the Nazis. That claim to fame and integrity and purity. So be it. I think that kind of speaks volumes to the nature of the circumstance which is at issue here in and of itself. Of course, that changes when you concede that it was 2 million, but 2 million is a figure that's advanced for essentially the same reason they advanced the 1 million in the first place. And the Smithsonian Institution, being a social scientific institution, emphasis on scientific, has always assigned to itself and had assigned to it by the remainder of the federal government a certain credibility in such things. And I think it's probably about time that there were a general questioning of what the scientific method was that was applied to any set of data in order to arrive at the estimation that there were 1 million or 2 million or any other particular figure with regard to the beginning population that was reduced to 250,000. And what you find with this, and I can turn to no less basically an enemy of American Indian interests than Francis Jennings to begin to unravel the whole thing. The answer in short form is none at all. If I were an IRS agent, I would stand here and say that the methodology applied was simply to cook the books. The books were cooked as follows. The book, as it were, is the aggregation of the original records of the incoming settling population. Nice euphemism there. Germans use the same one. The Germans that were taken from Germany to reoccupy the cleared sectors of Poland were called settlers. Invaders would be the proper word, but in the literature there's usual reference to settlers. Well, the original settling population encountered Indians along the East Coast. You cannot blame them for the fact that they did not realize that those populations they were encountering had already been dramatically reduced by something on the order of 1/3 to 50% by a pandemic of smallpox unleashed by Ponce de Leon in 1513. But when they show up 100 years later, they encounter Indians, and they're fairly careful about the counting of Indians, because the counting of Indians was the way in which, in their reporting back to their various crowns, they were able to attract support, financial, military, and otherwise, to their colonial endeavors. So they had a very good reason to make accurate counts in the numbers of Indians they were encountering. But somewhat mysteriously, within usually the first generation of their occupancy in North America, whatever the size of the population it was that they encountered in the initial 13 colonies of the eastern seaboard of the United States and in Florida and in Canada, those populations simply disappeared. Magic. And in their disappearance, there was a consolidation of the holding of what it had been, aboriginal property, the land, the resources of the land, and so on, and you begin to create the infrastructure that allows for the inculcation of what they call advanced culture, and within two generations, ultimately, you have a sort of intellectual elite beginning to emerge, one subpart of which is historians. And the historians of the now consolidated and evolving colonies are taking a look around at these records, and they look around themselves and they say, here's how many people of the Indian persuasion the original colonists said were here, and I look around and I don't see any at all, and I can't really reconcile this reality, so they must have been exaggerating in the first instance and arbitrarily cut the estimates in half. And Jennings walks you right through it. Whatever his attitude about Indians, he's got a sort of a perverse commitment to trying to identify truth, academically speaking, as he encounters it. And these guys offend him because there is no reasonable explanation of why they would arbitrarily have the numbers. There's no evidence leading them to this conclusion. They're doing no particular investigation. There's no field work going on. There's no countering testimony. They simply didn't like the numbers, so they cut them in half. And a generation or two later, they did it again. He counts four halvings of the original settler population's estimate. By the time Jim Mooney comes along, collates the information, decides there were probably 1.1 million Indians in a preliminary study that he has a good graces to call as such before he promptly dies, and they posthumously publish it by the Smithsonian. His protege, Al Kroeber, from out here in California, having examined the remains of the Indian societies are here after the 49ers got done with them, and I don't mean the football team, okay? This was Saturday evening recreation to go out and burn the nearest Indian village and butcher whoever came out, okay, to the point where you had a 90th percentile reduction of population by the late 1800s attributed in the official history of California to, quote, the wanton cruelty of the original settling population, and they weren't talking about the conquistadores. Well, he takes a look at what's left of the population and decides that a people that lives in such degradation couldn't have supported the numbers that Mooney was talking about. And so he arbitrarily, without further ado, without further investigation, with no application of method whatsoever, reduces the total by a further 10%, arriving at a point a little less than a million. You got a 1.1 million by a giant of American anthropology, and you got a revised estimate of a little under a million by another giant of American anthropology. And so what they did in the Smithsonian Institution, you know, compromise being the essence of politics, was split the difference between the two, arriving at that standard 1 million, allowing the United States government always, when the subject came up, to say it was no worse than the Nazis. Well, now they have to say they were a little worse than the Nazis, because when you add another million, the figures shift a bit. But does that conform to reality any more than the 1 million figure? Let's take a little bit of a look now, a glimpse at what it is that the Smithsonians and anthropology in general has always claimed it was about, applying scientific method to understanding a phenomena of this sort. You got a couple more guys here in Berkeley, Woodrow Borah and Sherburne Cook, who developed a method that, for lack of a better term, we could call agricultural archaeology. And what that is to quantify the acreage known to have been in cultivation at the time of first contact, based upon mission records, based upon the obvious ecological evidence that certain areas were in cultivation at a given point and have gone out of cultivation since, and so on. You could basically come up with a grid or a map overlaid with particular agricultural areas on a given bioregion or a given culture group. And it's fairly well understood what the nature of the crops were that were grown in these cultivated areas. And you got the land doesn't change that much as a general rule, so you know the relative degree of productivity of the land given the type of crop being grown. You've even got meteorological records that accrue through the mission journals and so on. And you can, on that basis, compute an average annual yield of certain types of foodstuff over, say, a 10-year span of time during the general period of first contact. And once you've got a yield of foods of the various types, agriculturally speaking, you can do a computation. How many people could be carried on that average yield in a manner sustainable through time? Okay? That's the method. Now, they applied it in Mesoamerica and in the Caribbean Basin. But another guy, who's a graduate student in Georgia by the name of Dobbins, takes the method and applies it to his particular area of preoccupation, which is Temequan population in the Florida Panhandle. Based on the acreage in cultivation, types of crop grown, meteorological records, and all of that, he comes up with an extrapolation based on the aggregate annual yield on the food of a Temequan population circa 1,500 of 830,000. That's Temequan. That's the Florida Panhandle. That's very nearly Al Kroeber's estimate for the entire continent. Now, he doesn't do the examination in his next area of study. He simply takes what other people have compiled with regard to the peoples who occupied the Piedmont Plain along the Atlantic coast of Georgia, the Carolinas, and up into Virginia. On the basis of that data, comes up with an estimated population for that region of up to 1.1 million. Now, that's Mooney's entire continental estimate there, and that's the higher of the two. For the Ohio River Valley, a little over 800,000, and to make a long story short, what he comes up with is an estimate of a maximal estimate for the entire area north of the Rio Grande, including Greenland, where it's estimated there were 10,000 Inuit, of 18.5 million. Now, when you start pegging 18.5 million to a quarter million survivors, the whole shape of things begins to shift pretty radically. But we got a Cherokee demographer, Russ Thornton, also spent a period of time here in Berkeley, who took a look at that, and he was a little unfair, I think, to Dobbins. He takes him to task for kind of exaggerating it. And the reason I say it's unfair is because Dobbins never said there were 18.5 million people here. He just said there could have been based on the evidence available. It's a maximal estimation. But Thornton says there's a number of cultural mediating factors that he didn't take into account, spiritual understandings or belief systems that would preclude certain lines of activity, ecological understandings, and blah, blah, blah. All of which would combine to suggest that indigenous populations would by and large not, at least on any regular basis, have conducted themselves in such a way as to saturate or arrive at the carrying capacity of their arable land base. And computing these things in, he then rolls the probable number back, I think maybe a little too far, because he reduces it by about a third to 12.5 million. Now, I'm not a professional demographer. And frankly, I don't encounter too many people who are. But if you assume, and I think there's good reason to assume, that maybe Dobbins maximal is overstating the case, but that a third below is probably a bit low and conservative, trying to cater to responsible academics, maybe you do what the Smithsonian did, or as Kirk Sale did, or Carl Sauer did, or as I do, and just split the difference between those two and round it out to a rough 15 million. Now, we're never going to go back and get a precisely accurate count. That's probably as close as you're going to get. What's interesting here is that it doesn't matter whether you want to take Dobbins' high-end number or you want to take Russ Thornton's far more conservative number, or you want to come along for the ride with Sale and me and others and just split the difference and call that good. 12.5 million, 15 million, or 18.5 million, where you end up when you peg that against a 237,000 surviving population in 1890 is an upper 90th percentile reduction. With a 12.5 of Russ Thornton, you end up in a 96th percentile. With the 18.5 of Dobbins, you end up in a 99th percentile. And if you take the 15 million figure, you end up between 97 and 98. Call that 97.5. I particularly like that, not simply because it's the moderate position in the middle of the scientific pack, but because of another piece of data they put out in the 1890 census. And it has an incredible explanatory value, I think. What they pointed out was that at that time, and it's still the case today, about 50 million acres of the original Aboriginal holding remained in Native hands. That's the reservation system. Nominally, at least, in Native hands, suggesting that 97.5% of the territory originally held by American Indians had been expropriated by 1890. A rather perfect symmetry, wouldn't you say, to a 97.5% population reduction. Percentile for percentile.
That was the first part of a one-hour lecture by the former professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado Boulder, Ward Churchill. Research is from his City Lights book, A Little Matter of Genocide. Come back when TUC Radio returns for the exploration of how possibly 15 million American Indians were reduced to 250,000. With that number, Churchill says, we are talking about a genocide that is unparalleled in terms of the size of population and in the way it was sustained through time. And in the upcoming TUC Radio program, Ward Churchill takes on the task of defining what their deaths mean for us living today. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. Please have a pen handy to write down a phone number to call to find out how to order the one-hour speech by Ward Churchill as audio CD. You can get information on how to order by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and on the web, and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly podcasts. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.